Trust me.
Dude, you trust me.
Trust me. I'm like a smart person.
Yeah, I've never lied to you. I never have lied to you.
If you think that one person has all the answers,
don't!
Welcome to Trust Me, the podcast about cults, extreme belief, and the abuse of power from two dummies who've actually experienced it. I'm Lola Blanc.
And I'm Megan Elizabeth.
Today, our guest is Janya Lawlich. She is a PhD researcher, author, and educator. Educator specializing in cult and extremist groups. She clearly, I am not education. She's the author.
Why is this so funny? Okay, I'm good. Okay, go on.
She's the author of a number of books, including her most recent one, Take Back Your Life, Recovering from Cults and Abusive Relationships. She's going to tell us about her own experience with a political cult called the Democratic Workers Party in the 70s and 80s, the horrible ways in which the members were expected to put the group over their own family, and how she got out and got her PhD studying influence and control.
We're going to talk about how to tell the difference between a legitimate political group and one that's leaning into cult territory, what bounded choice means, why you should always slow down even if you feel strong emotions about a group or individual, and red flags to look for in any relationship. Red flags, Lola. I fucked up too. So now we're even. Flags. Red flags.
I think you also maybe said legitimate it.
Oh, legitimated it. Legitimate. Okay, you guys, we are legitimate podcast hosts and everything's fine.
It's 10 a.m. and that is too early for us. We cannot talk at 10 a.m.
Oh, COVID has murdered my brain. Okay, she is so cool.
Well, I really love this interview. This is definitely one of my favorite ones of late. She's just so concise and her story is so compelling. Anyway, we love our podcast, so let's just talk about how great our podcast is. No, she's great. So anyway, Megan, please inform me of the cultiest thing that has happened to you this week.
Hey, I'm having a little bit of guilt. I'm having a little bit of guilt about it because he's kind of my cult leader right now in a weird way. But I had never watched Gordon Ramsay's Kitchen Nightmare before in my life. And for some reason, I don't know if it's new on Hulu or if it's been on Hulu, but I found it on Hulu and I've just been binge watching it. And he is so charismatic, so handsome. And I genuinely think he's doing great things and he's a good person. But there is a lot of aspects of that show that are a little bit cult leader-y with him.
I've never watched it. Please tell me more.
Well, okay. He comes in and he's this authority above anything that breaks you down and then builds you back up in kind of these sometimes manipulative ways. So, you know, I'm in the cult. I'm glad to be in the cult. I love him. I think he's really very handsome as well. So I'm all good with it. But it has been striking me lately that this is kind of fucked up.
Okay. I feel like someone was just telling me about this. So does he like, is that the one where he like shows up at your restaurant and he's like, this is why this is bad. Your restaurant sucks.
Yeah.
Aha. Okay. And I'm going to make it better.
Yeah.
Wow. Interesting. Because like in theory, that's like, that could be a really constructive thing, but it seems dangerous territory. I feel you. Yeah.
Definitely a narcissist for sure. So already narcissist plus people who need help equals sometimes some kind of stuff that I'm like, yeah, I don't like it. But for the most part, still on board. Definitely going to be watching it all night.
Are any celebrities not narcissists?
Ooh, that's probably Natalie Portman.
Okay.
I don't know. She doesn't seem like a narcissist.
I feel like Sarah Silverman seems like not a narcissist, but she isn't also, she's not like a megastar, you know?
Right. Right.
I don't know. Sometimes I suspect, you know, sometimes maybe they're all, maybe there's a reason.
Exactly.
They're super famous.
There's a reason always for everything. So that might just be it.
Is this just the excuse I make for myself for not being super famous yet? Because I'm not a narcissist.
You know what? If it works, use it.
No, it's okay. I don't need to be that famous. I just want to be respected in my field, okay?
Okay, Lola. And you are and you should be. You're amazing.
Thank you.
What's the cultiest thing that happened to you this week?
It also involves watching something. However, I've only watched one of the episodes, but I watched the first episode of Pray, Obey, Kill. Have you seen this yet?
I haven't even heard of it. What is it?
One of our fans actually tweeted at us about it, excited for us to talk about it. So maybe we should watch the whole thing about it when I've actually seen it, or both of us have. But it's a Swedish documentary about this murder that happened, I think, in the early 2000s. There was like a Pentecostal church, like a very small congregation, and one of the girls murdered like the pastor's wife.
Oh, my.
But here's the thing. She was getting text messages that she believed were coming from God, telling her that it was time to like go through with this murder and like get rid of this woman.
What?
Yes, there are 5 more episodes, so clearly there's a lot more information to come. It's like very complicated. I think there was like the priest was above her, but then he's saying that there's someone above him, and it's too early for me to know if he's telling the truth or not. But very multi-layered power dynamics going on that resulted in a murder and also an injury of a man who did not die, fortunately. But the pastor himself is like in the documentary. So I'm like,
okay,
this is fucking juicy. I can't wait.
I'm just wondering, like, what computer program do you have to use to like get a phone number that somebody's like, this is God? That's very strange.
Well, it just was that it was like getting a text message from like 562 or something, I think. But it just like doesn't say what the phone number is.
Right.
But wow. What's weird is as I was watching it, I was like, oh, yeah, I could see that.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
I was like mysterious text messages. I could totally see getting caught up in like if you don't know where they're coming from and they're saying such extreme things. And they were kind of confirming things she'd already been thinking. And how could they know that?
Wow.
You know, truly, technology is such a tool for indoctrination in ways we never even imagined.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think I'm in any text cults, though. Are you?
I don't know. I don't think so. I do get this eyebrow lady that I once went to. She sends some pretty crazy texts out sometimes, but other than that, I'm good.
I've gotten some insane DMs, but fortunately, no one has found my phone number yet.
Yeah, the DMs can get a little bit wild.
Yeah, yeah. Well, shall we talk to Yanya now?
Yes.
All right, let's do it. Welcome to the show, Yanya Lalich.
No, thank you. Thank you for having me.
So first of all, you are wildly accomplished in cult-related academia. Can you just tell us a little bit about your academic background and what you study or studied?
Well, I was in a cult myself, and then when I already had my BA then, because I joined when I was 30. But when I got out, I was 41, and I thought about grad school, but it took me about 10 years to actually make the decision. So I studied, it's actually a multidisciplinary program, but my emphasis was in sociology. Mm-hmm. And my dissertation was a comparative study of the cult that I was in and the Heaven's Gate cult, if you remember.
Oh, yes. We interviewed a former Heaven's Gate member.
That's when I sort of developed my theory of bounded choice. And so the user-friendly version of my dissertation was published by University of California Press in a book called Bounded Choice. So after I graduated, with my PhD, I got a teaching job at one of the California State Universities and taught in the sociology department until about, I guess, 3 years ago now that I fully retired and moved away from Chico to the Bay Area. So, yeah, I've been studying cults for about 30 years, 35 years.
A true expert.
I've seen a lot.
Yeah.
I've heard a lot of sad stories.
I can imagine. Well, let's start with your own personal cult experience. Can you tell us about the Democratic Workers Party, please?
Okay. So it was the mid-70s, and I had just come back from living on an island in Spain for about 4 years.
Cool.
Yeah, the end of my hippie years. And I ended up in San Francisco because a college friend was living there and had a room in her house and blah, blah, blah. you know, I was new in town. I was meeting new people, and I met a friend of a friend who we used to have coffee together. You know, we'd run into each other in the street and she'd say, oh, let's go have coffee. And so people on the left at that time, this was like the Vietnam War had ended. And so a lot of people on the left were trying to figure out what to do next. What should we focus on? So in my discussions with her, at one point she said, oh, well, we have a study group. Wouldn't you like to join our study group? And I thought, well, that sounded interesting. I'd meet new people and I love to read. I'm kind of an intellectual type. And so the purpose of the study group, we read a lot of like revolutionary leaders. And after about a month or so, she asked to meet with me again. And so the point of the study group was to get you to see that in order to make any kind of real social change, you needed to have a disciplined Marxist-Leninist organization. And then at the time, you know, there were all the examples of Cuba and Vietnam and Angola and these different countries who had, you know, fought off big powers. Mm-hmm. So they met with me again and said, oh, well, what are you learning? And I said, well, I'm learning that you need to have a discipline, blah, blah, blah. And she said, well, what if we told you we have one? Mm. And I'm like, what? You know, and so she said, yeah, we have this international organization, very diverse, which is all a lie. And, you know, would you be interested in joining? So I thought, you know, I was, you know, 30 years old. I wanted to do something with my life. I wanted to change society and fight racism and sexism and all that. So mm-hmm. I said, yeah, I'd be interested. So then, you know, this is the kind of bait and switch. So then she said, oh, well, here, first you have to fill out this questionnaire and then we'll get back to you. So in the questionnaire, of course, it asked me everything about my life, you know, my parents, my bank accounts, my passport number, everything I'd ever done.
Really?
Yeah,
oh, wow.
So they had, you know, they had all the goods on you at that point. Mm. So then I joined. I really didn't know what I was joining. I was pretty quickly moved up into leadership positions, in part because I was from the working class and most people at that point weren't. And so the leader kind of held me up as a model.
Oh, interesting.
So it was a very disciplined organization. We had to take on new names. No one was supposed to know anyone's real name. We had parking regulations, all kinds of security regulations. And in the beginning, we were underground. No one was supposed to know we existed. And then we surfaced and sort of had these different front groups that we used for recruiting, like either hospital workers or other union organizations in factories or community organizations. And that's how we'd recruit. And, you know, we worked 20-hour days, 7 days a week, year after year. It was completely exhausting.
Whoa.
We spent a lot of time sitting around in circles and criticizing someone for some, usually some trumped up thing.
Oh, no.
And of course,
that's my nightmare.
Yeah. And of course, you know, you had to participate in the criticism, otherwise you got criticized. And so this went on all the time. So, you know, it meant you were living a very anxious life. You know, you never knew when the shit was going to hit the fan, so to speak. And so it was very stressful and exhausting. And I did that for 10 and a half years.
Was there a particular leader at the top of it?
Yeah, she was a she was actually a sociologist. She had been a professor who never got tenure anywhere. And then some of her former students had invited her to San Francisco to be part of their study groups. And that's how she kind of formed the first thing. And she was very, very domineering, very self-assured, narcissistic, you know, the typical cult leader type. Mm-hmm. She had several homes that we put her in, and she was an alcoholic, which most people didn't know. So those of us in the inner circle kind of knew this and kept it from most of the membership. And, you know I would rationalize, well, you know, she's under so much stress. Or
right.
At one point I actually said, well, at least we haven't killed anyone yet.
Ooh. Oh, my gosh.
And, you know, things like that, that you would use to rationalize her behavior. Yeah, it was grim. It was grim.
Wow. That's a really interesting type of cult. We haven't really had anyone from political groups on. And there's, you know, there's a really big resurgence right now of Marxists who want to sort of overthrow the system, which I totally get. And I identify with a lot of those same goals. But how could the layman tell the difference between like a political organization that is like
legitimate,
genuinely benevolent? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Right. And one that's going down a dark path?
Well, I think there would be a number of factors. I mean, one is if the group is transparent, if you know where the money's going or where the money's coming from, if you're able to question and your questions are actually answered, typically, especially when you're joining, like you might ask a question and it'll get turned back on you, you know, or they'll say something like, well, that's a great question, but you don't know enough yet. You know, wait another month and then ask us that question. And of course, a month later, you don't remember the question because by then your brain is scrambled. So, you know, if they're answering questions, if you can challenge the leadership, if there are genuinely democratic discussions and democratic decision making, you know, those would all be signs. You know, if there are very strict rules like who you should live with or who you should partner with or things like that, you know, those are usually signs of a group that may not yet be a cult, but is a bit too controlling.
Mm-hmm. When did you realize that you were in a cult, or did you not realize till you left?
No. There are a couple of things that happened. The first one was I was in for about 5 years, and my mother, I was always very close with my mother, who was divorced, and she was back in Milwaukee. And at one point, I found out she was in the hospital. And so I borrowed money and got permission to go there. And she had a brain tumor, glioblastoma, which is the worst kind of brain tumor. So they operated, and I stayed with an aunt. And then they said, well, we'll take it out, but it'll grow right back. You know, so she has maybe 4 to 6 months to live. And so it got to be the time when they were going to discharge her from the hospital, and she really had nowhere to go. My brother wouldn't take her in. My sister was problematic. And so I called back to California and asked my leadership. I said, look, I'd really like to have a leave of absence and stay here, you know, till my mother passes. You know, they say it's going to be 4 to 6 months. And she said, oh, well, you know, I'll have to ask the queen bee. So she called me back the next day and said, oh, we have a great idea. Bring your mother out to California and she can live with you. Well, we lived in a very Serbian community. She was very old country in a way, and I don't think had ever really been out of Milwaukee, and was, you know, very enmeshed with her church, the Serbian Orthodox Church. So I said, oh, that's a great idea. You know, of course, I complied. And I came back. One of my roommates moved out, and my aunt put her on the plane to come out there. And so she was, you know, living in my house and was, you know, fairly disabled. And so I would go to work every day at like 6, 7 in the morning, come home at 11, 12, 1. I rarely saw her. And so at one point I said, look, you know, you had me bring my mother out here, but I never get to see her. And they said, oh, well, you can go home and have dinner with her. So I'd get 45 minutes to go home and have dinner with her. Then they decided she should work for the organization.
Oh, no.
So they had someone pick her up and take her to one of the front group offices called the Grassroots Alliance, where we did a lot of electoral work. And she was filing. I don't know. I mean, you know, they cut a lot of her brain out. You know, I don't know how she was doing that. You know, she was, her head was wrapped, you know, she had a wig and.
Oh my gosh.
And so she, you know, someone would take, bring her there, bring her back home. So it was about 6 weeks later, I came home one night and I opened my mother's bedroom door and she was lying dead on the floor.
Oh my God.
And I was just devastated. And so I called my best friend who I had recruited and she came over. And then I called my leadership. Well, of course, I called the coroner and all of that. I mean, I was just in shock. So I called my leadership and I said, my mother just died and, you know, I'm going to have her body flown home. And she said to me, well, you're not going to the funeral, are you? And I looked at the phone and I thought, here I am killing myself 20 hours a day to supposedly build a better world. And if this is the better world I'm creating, that I'm being told I can't go to my mother's funeral, something's wrong here.
Yeah.
So I said, no, I am going to the funeral. It was the first time I really like openly defied the organization.
Wow.
So then I went back and I have absolutely so little memory of any of this. I organized the whole funeral with my aunt. And afterwards, in our tradition, you have a big dinner at the Serbian Hall. And so you know, her sisters who were still living came, relatives came from Florida, from all over. We had this big dinner. And I was just like freaked out. In the middle of dinner, I got up to leave to fly back to San Francisco.
Wow.
And I'm sure those people were thinking like, what the fuck's wrong with her?
You know?
Right. So I got back and I was terrified. And of course, the next day I was told to report to a meeting, and they had all the leadership. They had about 40 people lined up in a room, and I was sitting in a chair in front, and I was criticized for putting my mother ahead of the revolution.
Stop it. Oh my God.
And so I was just criticized for hours sitting in this chair. And we had small group meetings called branches. I was assigned to go to every branch meeting and tell them what I did and why it was wrong, you know, as an example that, you know, they should never do that.
Wow.
And then when anyone was like thinking of going home or wanting to have a baby or whatever, I was the person who got sent to talk them out of it.
Wow.
So after that, I was completely miserable and I didn't want to be there, but I couldn't figure out how to leave. I was just paralyzed. And also from being in the inner circle, I had seen so much that, you know, I knew the leader was fucked up and, you know, that decisions were very arbitrary. And so that added to everything that I just wanted to get out. And we were never allowed to cry. So I would get up every morning and take a shower and just cry my eyes out and then get
in my car
to go to my facility. And I would just wish that I'd be killed in a car accident because it was the only way I could see of getting out.
Wow.
And I lived like that for 5 years.
Oh my gosh.
And then what happened is, which is very rare, we finally had our revolution and we overthrew our cult leader and we expelled her and we dissolved the organization. And so everybody got out at the same time.
Wow. How did that happen?
Well, you know, I was just one cog in the wheel who had this traumatic experience, but there were others, almost all in leadership, because even though we had privileges, we also had either experienced or were witness of horrible things. Mm. So people were just at their wit's end and stressed. And, you know, one guy actually chewed a hole through his hand just out of nervousness. And
so, Oh my God.
So she was leaving the country. She used to like to go to Bulgaria because it was communist at the time. And she thought that was heaven. And so she was leaving the country and the inner circle all got together and said, we're in a cult. And we called together all the members and told them what we knew. And it took 3 days to convince people that we were actually telling the truth and not trying to just have a takeover. Mm. So after, I guess, a week or 10 days, then we took a vote and voted unanimously to expel her and to dissolve the organization.
Wow, that's incredible.
Yeah.
I've never heard of that happening. That's amazing.
Yeah.
What was her reaction?
Oh, so when she came back, we picked a team of people to meet with her, and one of the women wore a wire so that we could all hear what went on. And
wow.
So her bodyguard went to pick her up, and the team got to her house ahead of time and got rid of all the guns, and she had a Rottweiler guard dog, and they got all that stuff put away. And she came home and she sat in her big leather lounge chair and sort of wanted to know what was going on. And so different people in this group, I think it was about 7 people, were trying to tell her, you know, the party's over, you know, and she kind of didn't get it. And at one point she pulled out a cigarette and held up her cigarette, and we did everything for her, right? So she held up her cigarette waiting for someone to come light her cigarette and no one got up to light her cigarette. And that's when she got it.
Wow.
And then she like stood up and threw down the cigarette and started screaming and like, how dare you, blah, blah, blah. We were actually very nice to her compared to how we handled people who were expelled, but she was given a month to get out of that house because a party member was paying the rent. And we took whatever we could, but there, she had lots of bank accounts in her name and stuff that we couldn't touch. And that was it.
That's like a cartoon of an evil prince, just like waiting for someone to come light your cigarette. What? That's crazy.
Yeah.
One thing I think that's especially interesting about her, or just like worth noting at least, is that she was a sociologist herself.
Yeah.
So I would think that that would just make people more likely to trust her and to think that she understands sociology. She's an expert, so she wouldn't create this kind of environment.
Exactly.
But it just goes to show that authority is irrelevant because people will abuse their power regardless.
Right. And actually, I mean, it was to her advantage because, first of all, she was quite a bit older than most of us. And, you know, so she had this credential. Oh, she was a PhD. She was Dr. Marlene Dixon. And and she could spout off. I remember the first lecture I went to, you know, I was invited to this special lecture, said it was just a select group of people. In fact, at that point, it was the whole organization. It was like 25 people. And we're sitting in the living room and she's sitting up at a desk in a chair and she lectures for like an hour and a half. And I was just like, wow. And then once I got my own PhD and started teaching, I realized she was just teaching us like sociology 101, you know, but, you know, you're primed to think that, you know, this person is so special and has so much special knowledge, you know, and that's the task of the cult recruiters to like build up this aura around the cult leader. So.
Yeah. Will you talk more about that, actually? First of all, priming is just something I'm so interested in general. The information you're exposed to in advance absolutely colors the way that you experience something.
Right.
What's an example of a way that someone might prime you to think that a cult leader is a special person?
Well, you know, it'll depend on the kind of group. You know, in our case, you know, when I joined, I didn't even know we had a leader. And then once I was in, they said, oh, yeah, you know, there's this woman. She's, you know, a brilliant theoretician. She's been published. She's she's like a big name in the women's movement. And, you know, the women's movement was quite big at that time, the first wave. And, you know, so they built up who she was so that it's called demand expectation. It's actually, there's a term for it that you're expecting this person to be a certain way. So you kind of convince yourself that that's what it is. And of course, if everyone else around you is oohing and aahing, you know, then if you think it's weird, you're like, well, there must be something I'm not getting. I better ooh and ah too if I want to be in this little group, right?
And so, right, like the emperor's new clothes.
Right. And, you know, with the, say, the guru type, the Eastern gurus, you know, they'll build you up by saying, oh, you know, he has this special aura. And when he comes into the room, you'll see a light shining around him and he'll lift himself up off the chair. And, you know, so again, you have these heightened expectations. And so you're primed to accept that this is really a special human being.
Right. And I think people might misunderstand that and think that that's a conscious process, but it's like subconscious things happening in your brain that make you actually experience it differently. Right.
Exactly. Plus, I think a lot of times when we talk about cults, enough emphasis isn't given to the importance of peer pressure. You know, cults are groups, they're social groups. And because of that, in any social group, you're going to be influenced by the people around you, right? And after we reach a certain age, we're far more influenced by our peers or our social relationships than, say, our parents or whoever, right? So you're in this situation that is relatively closed to begin with, you know, what I call a self-sealing system. It's kind of closed in on itself. You've begun to accept these people as your new family in a way, right? So if everyone is doing or acting or behaving a certain way, you're going to go along with that subconsciously, really, in many ways. It's no different than, say, you go to visit someone and you see all their shoes off at the front door. Well, what are you going to do? You're going to take your shoes off automatically without thinking about it because you realize that's the norm there, right? So all this kind of when in Rome, do as the Romans do, right? And that's it's a very powerful method of influence. So as much talk as there is about the leader of these groups, I do believe the peer pressure and that our peers within the group have far more influence on us and far more control over us in a way. and especially whoever is in those leadership positions. And they have what we call charisma by proxy, right? Because they're endowed with this privilege to lead by the leader, you honor them as well and you accept them as well. So it's really layers of the structure that are keeping you confined and constrained.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, some people never meet the leader, even in our group, as small as it was, there were people who got recruited toward the end who never saw her. They only heard about her from us, praising her and saying how brilliant she was. And that's common in a lot of groups.
Right. Like an example of that would be like Allison Mack in NXIVM, or what was her name?
Oh, Nancy Salzman.
Nancy.
Well, Nancy Salzman was very powerful. I mean, I believe Keith Raniere couldn't have done any of it without Nancy Salzman.
Really?
For sure. Yeah.
I really regard them as kind of co-leaders.
Mm.
She created the whole thing. She knew the psychological principles to use on people.
Sounds similar to Heaven's Gate. I always thought Heaven's Gate was a one-man show, and it wasn't until we, you know, learning more about it from the doc and from talking to our guest that I realized, no, it was actually definitely a dynamic duo until the woman died.
Yeah. And when it was a dynamic duo, she was the more powerful one. She was really the leader. She was the one who came up with all those exercises they did. And he, you know, in a sense, she recruited him and she was his cult leader.
Right.
Exactly.
I'm learning about so many more women cult leaders than I ever knew existed before doing this podcast.
Yeah, they're out there.
I thought it was a very,
male dominated.
Right, exactly. Can you talk about bounded choice and what that means?
Sure. The way I see it is we join these groups or get recruited into these groups that have four important parts, which are the charismatic authority, what I call the transcendent belief system, and then these interlocking systems of influence and systems of control. And the important part of the belief system is that within that belief system, there's a requirement that you have to go through a personal transformation. You have to change in order to be a part of that group and on the path to whatever salvation they're offering you, right? So as you begin to internalize all the rules and regulations and the devotion and the dedication, and it becomes your sole purpose for living, you have, in a sense, become like a little microcosm of the cult.
Mm.
You have so internalized everything that at a certain point, someone doesn't even need to tell you what to do. You know exactly what to do.
Right.
Right. And that's why cults can send people out, you know, wherever to recruit or run businesses or whatever, right? Because they're that, what I call resocialization. Some people say brainwashing. I find that to be a controversial word, so I kind of stay away from it, although I believe in it.
Mm.
But essentially what's happening is that you've been resocialized into this new person who is the perfect or trying to be perfect cult member, right? Member of this closed world.
Right.
Once you're in this closed world, which I call the bounded reality, and you've gotten to that point where you cannot imagine life outside of the group, right?
Mm-hmm.
At that point, you enter into this sort of mindset or state of mind called bounded choice, which means that, yes, you have choices to make. I mean, in most cults, you have some, quote, freedoms. You know, maybe you want to buy a car. Nobody's going to tell you what kind of car to buy, or nobody's going to tell you what colors to paint your house, or nobody's going to tell you what to buy at the grocery store. In some cults, they will, but not in others, right? So you have these small things that you can make decisions about that just kind of go along with the norm. But if there's ever a big decision, like, should I leave, or, should I report this to the authorities or whatever, big decisions are confined by this bounded reality in that, again, you know exactly the decision you need to make to stay in the good graces of the group,
mm-hmm.
right?
So that your free will, because especially in court cases and in the study of religion, free will comes up all the time. So yes, you have, quote, free will. Nobody's holding a gun to your head in most cases.
Right.
But your free will, in my opinion, is altered by the will of the leader and the will of the group,
mm-hmm.
so that your decisions are confined and constrained because of that.
Totally.
Yeah.
Sometimes I see it as the illusion of choice, because people think, oh, I have all these freedoms. Even in the Heaven's Gate case where they all sat outside in twos and said their goodbyes, you know, the goodbye tape.
Mm-hmm. Right.
They're saying, you know, I'm doing this of my own free will. No, over time, your free will has been altered and you're now functioning under the will of the group.
Right.
So I think it's an illusion of choice.
But how do you tell the difference? I feel like this question comes up a lot where you're they're an adult and they're making the decisions they want to make. How can we tell whether their choice is bounded or not?
Well, I think whenever you're making a decision that's against your own self-interest, it's probably not a valid choice made solely by you. I mean, you have to remember that once you're in a cultic situation or coercive situation, we see this even in domestic violence situations, coercive relationships. Once you're in that situation, you're really no longer functioning as you or who you used to be. Your whole value system and moral code has been altered, has been changed to coincide with the moral code or the amoral code of the leader, right? So that's why people do things that we can't understand when we're on the outside, why they kill, why they rob banks, why they give away their children, why they let their children be beaten, whatever it is. You know, people always say, how could a mother let that happen?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because that mother is a victim as well and is functioning as a good cult member and sees no other option.
Right.
So it's complex, and I know it's difficult for most people to understand because they say, well, you know, why didn't you walk away?
Oh, I hate that question.
Why don't the abused women walk away, right?
Right.
And that, you know, and that's the kind of guilt and shame that people feel when they get out. You know, so many say to me, why didn't I leave sooner? Why didn't I see this sooner?
Right.
Well, you couldn't.
Right.
There's a powerful system imposed on you. Of course you succumb to it.
I read something you said once that was like, everybody knew we were a cult except us.
Right.
And like, yeah.
Yeah. They used to write articles about us in the San Francisco papers and they'd say,
yeah,
you know, that we were Gaga for Marlene Dixon. And, you know, we were just, and this is funny. This is a good example of how people don't understand how they're perceived by the outside world because their minds are so closed and their vision is so closed. We took all those articles that were written about us saying that we were a cult. And we put them all together in a little booklet and we sold it on the street for 25 cents to show people how we were being red baited, right? That they were persecuting us. But basically, we
gave
the citizens of San Francisco all this ammunition
right.
that we were, you know, and somehow the leader thought that was a great idea. It's like, oh,
wow.
You know. Or the example of when my best friend who I recruited at one point in the cult, we were roommates. And I told you we had to have party names, different names.
Mm-hmm.
So my name was Emma and her name was Lillian, our party names. Her mother was coming to visit and they let her mother visit because she was an attorney and they let her do that. So her mother was coming to visit to stay with us for like a week. Her mother knew me before the cult. She had met me before the cult. She knew my name was Yanya.
Mm-hmm.
So her mother came to stay with us and the whole time, my friend, whose real name is Polly, she called me Yanya around her mom, of course.
Mm-hmm.
After her mom left, I turned her in to security.
Oh my gosh.
I said that she broke security because she used my real name in front of her mother.
Wow.
Knowing full well, I mean, her mother would have thought she was crazy if she was calling me Emma. It's like, who the hell's Emma?
Right.
But that's how distorted my own thinking was.
Mm.
That reminds me of Catherine from Nexium, don't you think, Lila?
Oh, Catherine Oxenberg.
Yeah. Where, you know, her mom was like...
India,
yeah.
Yeah. When you look back and you think, you see what the things you did, it's like, whoa, I was in another universe.
Right. The whole getting members to turn on each other for fear of punishment if they don't thing is just so sneaky.
Mm-hmm.
It's such a good tactic if you want to keep people under control.
Right. And that's, I mean, most groups will make a point of, you know, breaking up friendships, breaking up spouses, you know, Branch Davidians did that, all kinds of groups, having children raised by other people and not their birth parents. It's all to disconnect people from each other so that your only connection is to the leader.
Right. Do you think that kind of thing is, like, for example, the woman who led your group, do you think that that was a conscious decision on her choice? Or was, do you think she just subconsciously, like, had a feel for the fact that that would work?
Well, in her case, she actually, as part of her getting her own PhD, she actually studied behavior control programs.
Oh, no way.
Yeah. And she used to have me, I worked at a bookstore and another woman in the group was a librarian. And she used to have us get books for her on that topic of behavior control. But I think for many cult leaders, they probably don't study it, even though in my book, Take Back Your Life, we talk about how it looks like they go to the cookie cutter messiah school because they all do the same things. But I think, you know, when you're a narcissist or you're a control freak or you're a psychopath like Keith Raniere, I think these things come to you naturally.
Yeah.
And they've learned from seeing what other group leaders have done. And most of it is basic social psychology. In most cases, they're not, you know, they're not giving you drugs. They're not, you know, they're using basic social psychological pressures.
Right.
So wild.
The abusive relationship thing, I want to touch on that really fast because it comes up all the time. Cults get compared to them. But from an expert, I would love to hear maybe some signs that you're in a coercive or abusive relationship versus in an entire cult.
Well, I think, you know, some of the more obvious ones that probably most people are aware of is if your partner is separating you from family and friends, mm-hmm. you know, sometimes women are told to quit their jobs and just stay home. If you're being blamed for everything and, you know, you're gaslit to the point where you think everything's your fault. Mm-hmm. Actually, last year I wrote a memoir and part of writing the memoir, I dug out journals that I had, which I didn't even realize I had. And I realized that I was in an abusive relationship back in the 60s when I was a hippie. So I was in an abusive relationship with this guy who used to throw furniture at me, hit me.
Oh, wow.
You know, while we were taking LSD and, you know, all this stuff. And
Whoa.
And, Nightmare.
Yeah. And in my diary, in my journal that I read, the whole time I'm writing, I have to be a better woman for him.
Oh.
It's all my fault. I'm the one who sets him off all the time. So, you know, if you're having those kinds of feelings, you're probably in an abusive relationship. Everything is never always all your fault.
Right.
A relationship takes two people. And I think, you know, the kind of either an insistence on towels have to be folded exactly the same way or dinner has to be done exactly the same way and on the table, you know, all those kinds of little petty little things that we hear about that these partners freak out about and start throwing dishes across the room. All of that should be a sign that this is not a healthy relationship.
Right.
And, it, you know, I don't think every abusive relationship is not necessarily a cult.
Right.
It can become a cult. There are one-on-one cults or very small family cults. But basically the same techniques are being used to control and confine you, you know, get you to obey, basically.
What do you think the first step is to getting out?
Run out the door. No, I think it's obviously very hard to get out. Do whatever you can to stay in touch with family or friends. And sometimes that's a dangerous thing to do if the partner finds out. But I think you have to have a lifeline.
Yeah.
And I think for friends or family who has someone in that situation, it's important to be that lifeline.
Right.
It's important to always let the person know that you're a safe haven for that person. They can come to you any time of night or day and you won't humiliate them. You won't say, see, I told you he was a bad guy. Just take them in and love them and hug them and let them sleep and let them heal.
Right.
But I think in those cases, in many ways are much harder to break free from than a cult where there's lots of people and
right.
In a one-on-one relationship, everything's focused on you.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's much harder to break away from that. You're probably not even alone that much.
Yeah.
And then especially when there's children involved, there's always so much fear about what's going to happen to the children. And
right.
As in cults, what happens is you lose your self-esteem. You lose your sense of self. You lose your self-confidence. So you can't imagine you could actually get up and go out the door and that you'd be safe.
Right.
Because you're so refreshed.
Yeah. I was in an emotionally abusive relationship, which I took a really long time to be able to describe it that way, because I was like, well, he never hit me.
Right.
He never hit me. So that doesn't count.
It's like we never killed someone.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Exactly.
Just actually the other day I was talking to a male friend about it, and I was sort of describing very briefly what happened, and he summarized it by saying, so he was jealous. And I was like, no, he wasn't jealous. Like, yes, he was jealous, but he was literally telling me I couldn't hang out with certain friends. Mm-hmm. I started to feel like I couldn't tell anyone what was going on. Mm-hmm. I kept thinking that if I could just find the right words to convince him of X, exactly. Y, or Z, then he would be better. Mm-hmm. I just needed to do a better job of whatever it was that I was doing. You know, it's not just like, and yes, he also yelled and would be very hostile and confuse me and gaslight me. But there's a whole host of other things besides, oh, so he was jealous.
Exactly. You know? Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's so subtle. It's so subtle. I just feel like there's not enough general awareness about what emotional abuse actually is when there is no hitting involved. Right. You know,
I don't know. Are you familiar with the work of Jess Hill?
No,
no.
She discovered me, or I discovered her, I'm not sure, on Twitter, which I've suddenly gotten on Twitter and a whole other world. I'm still trying to figure out Instagram. But anyway, she's Australian, and she's a journalist, and she's a specialist in coercive relationships. Mm. And I just got her book. It's a huge book, and it's called See What You Made Me Do.
Mm.
It was first published in Australian, and then she did a more of an English language version to be published here. So it's available on Amazon. But you know, I think you're so right about that. People think, well, if there's not physical abuse, there's not really abuse.
Right.
And, you know, why can't you just yell back or, you know.
Right. What measures can people take to protect themselves from a harmful group or a harmful leader or abusive relationship?
I think probably, first of all, to just slow down. Like, don't jump into things right away. You know, if people say to you, oh, come to this seminar because this guru is only going to be in town next week. No, the guru will be back. Don't worry about it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think slow down. I think really check things out. Even if it's your best friend telling you to do something, join something.
Right.
Really do your own research. And there's so much on the internet today about different groups, of from people who've left groups or lawsuits or whatever. And I think it's important to do that research. I think it's important, if you can, to try to talk to people who were in the group and left.
Right.
But I think the biggest thing is that people jump into these things too fast.
Mm.
And I understand that. Recruiters are very good at what they do, and they're very good at getting you to sign on.
Mm-hmm.
But I think if people were more cautious and sort of looked at joining something as the same way as they would buying a car, right? You don't buy the first car you look at, right?
Right.
And so, you know, to be better consumers for their spiritual life or their self-improvement life or their political life or whatever it's going to be, is to really slow down and check things out.
Right.
You know, and the minute you find your questions aren't answered, or, you know, the minute you ask about money and they tell you to, oh, don't ask that right now, or, you know, anything like that, if there's a lack of transparency, there's a lot of other groups out there that someone can join that are healthy.
Right. I think so often, because people have a really, you know, sort of an intense emotional experience for a lot of
right.
these groups, they trust that emotional experience, and they think that those feelings must mean that there's something real
really
there.
Good. Right.
Yeah. I was once talking to somebody, and they're like, how could it be fake if I like get these goosebumps when we sing hymns? And
right.
I was like, have you ever been to a concert? He's singing gives you goosebumps.
Right.
It's like very beautiful.
Right.
Like, what?
No, exactly. Yeah. It's what we call those high arousal techniques. And they can happen in any context, like you just mentioned, like at a concert. But again, when you're primed to have this kind of experience, and then you have it, and then you think, oh, that's real. But it's not real. It's a manufactured experience to get you to not consider your critical thinking part of your brain, but to consider the sort of pleasure emotional part of your brain.
Mm.
You know, that's why I think, you know, slowing down is really important, and doing research.
Yeah.
And you know, unfortunately, we live in a very quick fix society, which I think has been true since about the 60s and the beginning of the New Age movement, and well, not the beginning, but the continuation of the New Age movement, that people want a solution right away. That's really been the tendency, I think, of a lot of people in this country, that they can easily find a way to solve whatever it is. And so there's a tendency to, you know, listen to these people who say they have the grand solution for you.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Rather than going to therapy, which could take a long time. Yeah.
Or, you know, trying to just lose weight on your own by running up and down the street or, you know, whatever it might be.
Right. Wow. Well, this has been great. Is there anything that you want people to know or any final words or messages for the people?
People should know about my website, which is cultresearch.org. And there's a lot of information there on different things that we've talked about today, as well as my books, links to Amazon, I guess, or wherever for my books. And also, if they want to email me, there's a way to email me through the website, and that'll come to me. So
great. Well, thank you so much. This has been a really great interview. I feel like I learned so much.
Yeah.
Very enlightening. Thank you. Yeah.
Okay. Well, thanks so much. I really enjoyed it.
Wow. I loved that interview. Very cool lady. Such great work that she's done. So, Megan, do you think that you would join the Democratic Workers Party or, let's say, any sort of Marxist political group?
I don't know. The way she told it, the time and place, I can see myself maybe getting involved in something like that. Sure. And then really believing this woman that's telling me I'm not doing enough. Because once you start getting involved with things that really matter, you're never doing enough, you know?
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's so true, actually. I've been reading this book on morality. I'm taking forever to read it because it's not actually that good. But
right, because I'm not actually that moral.
Well, that too. But one of the like dilemmas that they talk about is like, if you believe that you should be spending your time helping as many people as you can and using as many of your resources as possible to help other people, then where is the line?
Right.
Like, should you, why do anything for yourself then? Because other people are suffering. And my actual belief is that you have to take care of yourself. And if something is starting to impact your own quality of life, well, you're a person that matters too. Therefore, you know, it is moral to take care of yourself. But I could see so easily getting caught up in that idea that like, well, I need to be helping people, so I have to be doing more. Yeah. I can't take time for myself. I can't have my own identity. I need to keep going, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I totally see that. I think I absolutely would be susceptible to a group like this. No fucking question.
Yeah, for sure. You know, it's kind of right up your alley.
Yeah, I've already been in like social justice or activist groups. Like politics are very important to me. I could totally see that happening. And that's why I asked that question. I was like, how do you tell the difference between like a legitimate political group with reasonable goals versus a group where it's like you're just... everyone has decided that this one person knows more about communism or knows more about fighting patriarchy or whatever the fuck it is.
Right.
And therefore you have to listen to every single thing that they say and never question, because that's a problem too. Anyway. Yeah, totally susceptible to this kind of thing, but, not in one.
Yeah,
so
same.
That's good.
Not in one yet.
TBD. We'll keep you posted.
Thank you all for listening. Have a wonderful week, and remember to follow your gut, watch out for red flags, and never ever
trust me. Bye.
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.